Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Kirk now. Kirk, I began today apologizing for yesterday, since there was so much, so many claims made yesterday that are untrue, that I thought that it was a credibility hit to the program. And you know, I talked to Scott during the break, and his view was, you know, but you turned it into a teaching moment today to, you know, explain why you ought not go towards these conspiracy theories as opposed to deal with the evidence. What's your view?
Well, I agree with Scott. I thought it was fine. I mean, it's not. People are going to have different views and come on the show, and you can't get them up to speed. There's so much information proving certain points of view. You can't bombard them with all of it, you know, and
right.
Have a conversation. You let them say what you say and say, well, it's okay to agree to disagree at this point and then follow up later if you feel it needs more clarification. Most of our audience is pretty sophisticated, I think, enough to deal with that. And, you know, he's got some the one thing that I walked away, I listened to it on tape, and the thing that I was walking away from is a whole week of, I've been listening to the news here about satellites and how the World War III starts up there in the space with knocking out all the communications, and then follow this a minute. You,
by the way, I'm not sure that's the case. Just
well, I don't think it, no, but that's, I'm just saying this is what's being said out there.
Right. And let me tell you what, I don't think that's the case. By the way, it's just that, for example, our GPS satellites, they're at extremely high orbits. And there are many, many of them. And there's only one way that I'm aware of that you can actually take one out, because they're already protected for EMP blasts. And the only way to take them out is that there's the way they got there, which is an intercontinental ballistic missile.
Uh-huh.
And so taking out each of them is extraordinarily difficult and extraordinarily expensive. And it's not like the low Earth satellites.
Yep.
You take out one of them, the others are not going to run into the debris. Because the debris is going to fall below that orbit level, and they're very, very far apart at very high levels. And most of our spy satellites are very high. And so from a communication and satellite point of view, this is a very difficult task. The low satellites, different story.
Yeah.
But most of the military satellites, they're launching those things on intercontinental ballistic missiles. They're very, very high.
Mm-hmm. But everywhere I turned, there was, like I also did the economic news and mm-hmm. the stock market and the commodities exchange, and everyone is absolutely, it's not even suggested that we're in for some really bad times ahead. They're talking horrible times ahead.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in my lifetime, I've never seen that where so many independent people are not seeing. Even though their perspective hasn't gotten to the Torah yet, and what God actually says, so they can be very specific and trust Him, they still, the whole world now, everywhere I turn, they just go, my God, this has to end this way badly.
Yeah.
Because the dollar can't survive, you know, and the yuan is coming, and on and on. Everything I've read for years anyway, but still, it's all over.
Yeah, I have. I spent this weekend down in Texas with both of my boys, and during dinner we talked about where we are as a world. Hmm. And my sons are unique in the sense that everybody thinks their sons are unique, but my sons actually are unique in that they're probably the smartest siblings in the world. They both have IQs over 175. It's one in like 100 million people.
Mama.
Yeah, you got it from their mom. It's one in 100 person, one in a 100,000 to one in a million that would have an IQ above about 160-ish. So to have two that are both 175, and the only reason I mention this is that both have investigated the evidence. They're both very well read, very well educated, and they've investigated the evidence, and both agree that it is absolutely inevitable that we're going to have total and complete societal collapse, and that that collapse is somewhere between 5 and 10 years out, and that the reset is going to be extraordinarily painful, and that the reset is going to be done on a blend of economic terms and militaristic terms. They both have come to the conclusion that the U.S. military is counterproductive, that our educational system has been a disaster, and that the entitlement mentality is has bankrupt the nation. And frankly, if you're looking at the evidence, you know, I was Donald Trump is actually a fairly smart guy. I'm not political, and I'm certainly not going to ascribe any credibility to Trump. I think he says a lot of stupid things. But yesterday I listened to him, and he's a very well-educated man. I went to Wharton School of Finance and was talking about his what the Democrats would say is his anger, what Republicans say is a nasty tone. And he said, listen, folks, you know, if you just think that America can resolve the fact that we're a train wreck, mm-hmm. and that things are not good here, and we are at the cusp of a really, really bad situation, and you think you can resolve that without passion, without aggressiveness, without a real strong drive that says, no, this isn't acceptable. And by pushing aside political correctness, I'm here to tell you that another president like the ones we've had, the inevitable is upon us.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you. I think that it is well known that we're on the precipice of total anarchy.
Yeah. It's I was just amazed it is so pervasive everywhere that they're talking this way. It's not even an option. You know, it's not pie in the sky. They're talking as if this is inevitable. And,
yeah. And you still have these discussions like you have Bernie Sanders, who will admit that he's a socialist. I would call him a communist. But he will admit that he's a socialist, drawing huge crowds, telling people that the economic system is rigged and that billionaires can't have it all, playing economic warfare, class warfare, and promoting things that would be the same kind of rhetoric that you would have gotten out of Lenin and Karl Marx in Russia circa 1917.
Right.
And then you hear that kind of rhetoric being popular in a country that has gone down that socialistic path to bankruptcy. And people saying, yeah, man, he's the truth teller. He's enlightened. He's got this moral compass. And you go, good God, what happened to your brain?
Yeah. What morality is it that we all go broke?
Or that you ought to reward people who are not productive by stealing the assets of those who have been productive. And how is that a good thing? How is that moral?
Well, even in Greece, you ask them, you know, if you raise your taxes, how are you going to get anybody to invest there? And if you can't protect your investment, why would I invest there?
And if I'm going to restrict your savings after I've taxed your earnings, that now I'm going to restrict your savings so that you can't take it out of the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Why would anybody invest there?
Money in the bank, yeah.
Right. Why would you take any risk to build a business?
Yeah. So you leave.
You leave?
They had it.
If you have any ability, you leave. If you're a dependent, you stay. And so you get a whole country of nothing but dependents.
They have people, whole several family groups all living with their family. They've all moved back in home like they do here in Greece in there. It's just terrible.
You think there's a reason that Yahweh said to Abraham, who was in the capital of the most powerful country of its day, walk away?
Yeah,
leave your country?
Yeah.
You know, when you're dependent upon all of the social institutions, they are dependent upon the religion for your soul. You're dependent upon the government for your protection, the military for your protection. You're dependent upon the establishment for, you know, the rules of the road that you operate under. When you are dependent upon government, then you're not independent enough to even process the information that Yahweh has presented, much less make an informed decision about it and walk to Him.
Mm-hmm. No, you're overwhelmed.
Right.
Buddy.
Right. And were the governments of Babylon any different than the government of King Saul that Yahweh warned his children about?
No, he would have gotten there if they continued. Well, they did get there, didn't they? Then it wasn't.
Well, yeah, he did.
Duh.
Yeah, he did. He got there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, bread and circuses, and then if you remember in the Roman Empire, a lot of that period, once they conquered Egypt, they brought all the wheat in, and it wiped out all the wheat farmers and Italy. So,
correct.
You know, so why would they invest there? Why would they?
Rome fell because there weren't any Romans that were doing anything other than plain military.
Yeah.
I mean, they built weapons. And they built the means to transport their weapons and the weapon wielders, and they used their weapons and the weapon wielders and the means to transport them to rob everyone of their children, of their wealth, of their land.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after a while, you can't successfully, no matter how miserable and perverted and deadly, we think of crucifixion, which was the Romans' favorite tactic to garner compliance. I don't care how draconian you are, after a while, when you are that immoral, people will rebel against you because there's nothing to lose.
And
that's the epitome of government. If you want to know what government ultimately becomes, it's Rome.
Yeah. And that's why it gets said it's going to be alive forever, till the end, brother.
Right. Well, because the politics of Rome became the religion of Rome. And the religion of Rome is worse than the politics of Rome.
Yeah. It gives it a reason for being. You can do that because religion says so.
Wow.
God and king. God and king is always a good politics, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, we were on this statement in Paul when we left off, and I want to read it again. And I want to ask you a question about fellowship. And it says, then having known and having recognized the grace. Now, having recognized the grace, did you find any grace in the Torah when you read it? How about the prophets and Psalms?
No, you have to stretch. I'll tell you what they did to the word.
It would be interesting to see what did Yahweh say about promoting the names of pagan gods.
Don't get around me with them.
It says, having known and having recognized the grace of the one having been given to me, the grace. Do you find the names of, this is the gratia. The gratia is how we, if you read the Latin Vulgate, which was the principal Bible of Christianity for better part of 1,000 years, the only Bible of Christianity for better part of 1,000 years, the Latin Vulgate. The word there is gratia. That's the name of the graces, which was the Latin name of the charis, the charities in the Greek religion. And the charities and the graces, in fact, having been to both of these countries, they are among the most prominent of the pagan gods and goddesses to be displayed. In Pompeii and Herculaneum, on all of the decadent Roman villas, in the big living areas, it's always the gratia. And like in the Parthenon, it's the cherries. These were not just goddesses. They were the goddesses of the kind of mindset of the Greeks and the Romans, which was decadent. They were hedonistic, is what they're, of debauchery. You know, merriment in the sense of Caligula's definition of merriment. And so to say, he wrote this in Greek, so he wrote the charis. And, you know, this is the Christian that would say, well, you know, they're Jesus, Yosha. Is quoted in Revelation using the same word. No, he's not.
No.
What did he speak in? What language did he speak?
I think it was Hebrew. Left.
Yeah, Hebrew. So it was some moronic cleric way long after the fact that changed and translated in an attempt to translate what he said in Hebrew, which he would have said chanan in Hebrew, mercy.
Mm-hmm.
That they changed mercy, chanan, to charis after the pagan gods and then to gratia in Latin. It was a idiotic translator in a employed by some religious institution.
Well, to keep my perspective intact, I went through all the Christian normal approaches of translating this last night, and I picked out about four words that, and this is one of them. And you have to go. They try to make it kanon, but they try to say that it's unmerited favor. And you just change the definition of the word, and then you can use the word. But you have to go really away from those lexicons in order to find some history lesson and find that it is the graces. Now, you don't have any trouble in the art field where I am, because up until the 19th century, it's one of the most popular themes used by all the great painters.
Because they were the most beautiful of the beautiful forms.
You draw three naked women, you know, and nobody cares. And the grace is okay because they're the graces.
Right, they're the graces.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So that's what they got around the more circumspect preachers and all, or priests. And so you could do anything as long as it was mythology. So I say they gravitated to those things.
Exactly.
You know, Jana?
Yeah.
I agree with what you're saying about the etymological derivation of the word, grazer. But a linguist might make an argument that words over time can be fairly divorced from their etymological origin. So, such that, you know, when a modern Spanish speaker says gracias or an Italian says grazie, he's not thinking of these goddesses at all. You know,
he's
when we use the word gratitude, we're not realizing it.
Correct.
You know, let's not forget that we're still on a regular basis saying Woden's Day, Thor's Day, Tuesday, and Freeman's Day.
What you've said is true, but it doesn't exonerate Paul. Paul wrote in 50 to 52 CE, and in 52 CE, Charis was the name of those goddesses, period.
Right.
And so it absolutely, the fact that Christians have tried to disassociate Charis from gratia and gratia from grace, and to evolve a concept for it that is satisfactory for their religion, to divorce it from Dionysus and the charities, is true, but it doesn't exonerate Paul. What Paul wrote was absolutely pagan at the time that he wrote it. There was no evolution of the word at the time that in 52 CE.
So did God inspire him to say that? I don't think so.
Zero chance. Could the disciples have seen the perversion of the Charis in Paul? Absolutely. Is it a good thing? No. So if we get by the use of the pagan goddess's name, Charis in Paul's nomenclature, gratia by the Roman Catholic Church and grace by Christianity today. He says that, and having recognized and known the grace of the one having been given to me, Kephish and Jacob Kephish and Yahuchanan. It's interesting, he starts with Jacob, who despised him, and Shimon Kephish, who despised him, and Yahuchanan, who essentially was pitted against him. I mean, the whole experience, all of Revelation's open letter to the Ephesians and Paul's letters to Timothy are about the battles between Yahuchanan and Paul, John and Paul. The second letter that Peter wrote, Shimon Kephish, pits Peter against Paul. And in this letter, Paul is pitting himself against all three. In the entire book of Jacob, there isn't a Christian in the world that doesn't understand the book of Jacob. was written, James was written expressly to contradict Paul. And yet he's claiming that these three guys reached out to him. Now, he does something here that's really important first. He associates them with Doceae, the ones that were presently presumed and regarded to be pillars. So he's telling you that the people whose message meant nothing to him, that he totally rejected, that were false, were these three guys, the three disciples. So he's affirming what we've said on previous programs. And then he says that they gave him the right hand of fellowship. Why would James write a letter, Jacob, condemning Pauline Christianity? Why would Yosha speak of the false apostle that was opposed to Yahochanan in Ephesus? Why would Shimon Kefesh say that Paul's letters were misleading and counterproductive and lead people away from Yahweh, if in fact this was the right hand of fellowship? Some fellowship, huh?
Well, even further, that being true, it's very awkward because I've tried to translate it into English from the Greek, and mm-hmm. the only way you can do this properly, and to me, you would have to say, he said that they were supposed
pillars. Right.
Now, when supposed. You say something like supposed, or I might say supposedly these guys are the pillars of a community or something, that is such a sarcastic way to say mm-hmm. something about someone.
Yes, which, demeaning.
Yeah,
demeaning.
It's totally
demissive.
Then you
demissive.
Turn around and, yes, and so he has dismissed them, and
right.
then he's saying that their endorsement is somehow
right.
worth your noting. Are you noting?
Right. Yeah, no matter how you look at this, it is so reprehensible, so disgusting, so irresponsible, so irrational. That the fact that a religion grew out of this, that the most popular religion in the world, just speaks of how thoughtless most people are. You know, and the people that he was demeaning, listen, we demean people all the time on the show.
Oh, yeah.
And we demean the pillars of society. We don't call them the supposed pillars of society. The pillars of society, military leaders, political leaders, religious leaders, and we're exposing them and condemning them all the time. We don't call them supposed. Because they are the very people that are responsible for these counterproductive institutions. But he is here demeaning Yosha's disciples, and not just the disciples, the big three.
Mm-hmm.
That's like saying, you know, this guy that I'm claiming I'm speaking on behalf of, he was an idiot. He picked these three idiots. And so I'm just going to call the ones that he picked and trained and sent out and equipped and empowered, I'm going to call them supposed pillars, presumed pillars, to demean them.
And then it's important that they endorse me.
Now, they said they're right hand in fellowship. When Yahweh is talking about fellowship in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, what is the basis of fellowship with man?
Well, it's an honorable place. It's you're becoming part of the family, or you're...
Yeah, the family, the covenant, right?
Yeah, sure.
Every reference to fellowship in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is based on the covenant. Is offering a right hand one of the conditions of the covenant?
Well, I don't know if I'd put it that way, but I mean, it's
You always got five conditions. The covenant is offering
a right hand, five conditions, sure, five fingers, five digits. Okay.
I'm just saying that Paul is claiming that in his fellowship, that the sign of this fellowship is the offering of the right hand. I've read the terms and conditions of the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
There is no condition that says that the sign of acceptance into the fellowship is offering to the right hand. The sign of acceptance of the covenant is circumcision.
Yes.
Not offering the right hand.
Yes.
So what is he talking about here? I mean, if he wanted to say, you know, you're part of the club, then circumcision is the sign. Not offering the right hand.
I'm still trying to figure out how he could have said the first line, because the meeting was done in Hebrew, not in Greek.
Correct.
How did you get the grace in the Hebrew? we know he's not repeating something that actually was said there.
Well, because he's writing to Greeks and writing to Greeks and Romans, and the Greeks and Romans loved their naked little girls.
Yeah.
And the naked little girls are part and parcel of the Dionysus cult. And Paul was all over that Dionysus cult, man. Absolutely.
So many internal evidences in here that would prove that this is just a false BS he's made up.
Oh, of course.
That how does it gain
traction?
Yeah.
How does it gain traction?
I mean, I'm not that smart. I'm not that smart. I can dig a little bit and start asking these questions that don't make any sense and.
Listen, I don't think it's about smart. I think smart can help you. Smart is typically processing information quickly is the kind of the definition of smart. But knowing these things, every Christian knows that this is in Galatians 2:9. Every scholarly Christian, and understanding are two different things. What you possess is a vastly more important thing than necessarily being smart. That's understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And we are all capable of understanding. It just requires the proper perspective and an affinity for evidence, a desire to learn what can be known, and then making the necessary connections. We're all capable of understanding, no matter how fast or slow we process information. So, yeah, it's obvious to you. It's obvious to me because we understand.
And then you go to the tablets of stones, and you can't have God's with me, behind me, beside me. Don't come around with that stuff.
The first statement says you will not exist with other gods in my presence.
Right.
You will not. What part of that sounds like he's going to accommodate the gratia, the charities, and the graces?
Yeah.
You will not exist with other gods in my presence. That's the first statement he etched in stone.
I was going to say some of these, if you look at the English translations of the words, sort of like a mercy, grace, or charity as agape, you know, God's love. So a lot of Christians don't understand the distinction even between mercy and grace. They think them as similar words, like just kind of mean nice or kind.
Right.
If grace is translated as unmerited favor, mercy is actually more so as healing. But, understand the importance of parsing all this stuff and making these points. But actually, I want to point out there is a good case for, apart from the word controversy, making the case that much of Yahweh's favor is unmerited. I mean, it was unmerited to call Abraham out.
If you're going to understand and translate Chanan and understand what Chanan means, like Yahweh Kanan, if you're going to understand the concept of Chanan, which is unmerited favor. Mercy. No issue with that at all. But
we didn't know the Hebrew word, but wanted to make the point of the importance of the concept. You know,
right. And by the way, there were Greek words that weren't the name of pagan goddesses that communicate the concept of mercy, of undeserved favor, and there's about six of them. And one of them was not the name of the pagan goddesses. So he chose the name of the pagan goddesses as opposed to choosing the Greek words that properly translate the concept of Chanan, of mercy.
Right.
So why don't the translators of the future Bibles, why didn't they change it back to unmerited favor?
Because they have the gospel of grace.
I know.
Because Christianity is based on the gospel of grace.
What is,
why did the publishers of English Bibles write to the Lord as opposed to Yahweh's name?
Oh, so it just attacked, it's them.
Right.
No place for them to hide.
No place for them to hide. They deliberately and knowingly perpetuate the lie, because the lie is what enriches them and empowers them. And if you were a victim of that lie, shame on you. Now, this, of course, ends... after it has the word fellowship, which, according to Yahweh, there's only, and by the way, it's koinonia, which is very interesting, that Christians will use the word koinonia all the time. It's one of the Christians' favorite words is koinonia. And they'll use that to speak of fellowship as opposed to bereth, covenant, because they just hate Hebrew, not knowing that Yahusha and God, Yahweh, never once spoke Greek. So here you are with koinonia, and yet this koinonia is entirely different, because he goes on to say, we, and he's speaking of himself and Barnabas, who is soon going to be leaving him. So you got to extract Barnabas there, because Barnabas is bye-bye, to the nations and ethnicities, to the ethnos, but they to the circumcision.
Okay, now let me throw something in.
Okay.
We may have to go to break, but I was told that Matthew dies in Egypt, Thomas dies in India, Peter obviously in Rome, John grew old in
Ephesus.
Mm-hmm. In Ephesus. What are they doing there if they were just going to the circumcised?
Who's lying? History or Paul? Yahusha or Paul? If their message was the same, if their inspiration was the same, if they represented the same God, since they were both Jews, all Jews, why would Yohanan's, Shimon Kefesh, and Jacob's, James, Peter, and John's message be wholly limited to circumcision, while Paul, based upon this, has the rest of the world? And why is it, as you said, that these three guys all ended up outside of the world of Yisrael, if what Paul was saying was true?
Good question.
Every time that we did a whole show on James had sent us the references, every time that Yahweh used the term uncircumcision. And every time Yahweh uses the term uncircumcision, which is the group that Paul claimed that he had, that was his message. He's reaching out the message and preaching the message of uncircumcision. Every time Yahweh mentions uncircumcision, without fail.
Derogatory.
It's derogatory. It's failed. Inadequate. Disgusting. Distance. Estranged from him. Mm-hmm. Deadly.
Unacceptable.
Unacceptable. And here's Paul saying, that's my message, man. I am the message of uncircumcision, of failure, of derogatory, of opposition to God, of unacceptable.
Well, you're just turning down the covenant contract. If you don't want to sign the contract, don't sign the contract. We don't claim you signed a contract if you ain't going to abide by it.
Oh, and more importantly, don't claim that you're speaking on behalf of the God who signed the contract.
Yeah. I mean, this ain't complicated stuff here.
Yeah, you know, he claims that his religion is faith based because Abraham didn't have the Torah, and that Abraham accepted righteousness based upon faith, which is so he's talking about that same Torah, mm-hmm. And yet what did Yahweh tell Abraham that he absolutely had to do if he wanted to be part of the covenant?
Yeah, he had to be circumcised.
Right, and. Where does it say that Abraham had faith?
Nowhere, because it's not the word used.
No.
Trust and reliability is a
right
word.
In right. Exactly, because he knew him personally. Mm-hmm. And so all the way through here, what you've got is Paul not only lying, but the lie is veneer thin. And he's putting this veneer right over the truth.
Question.
Yeah.
Where did Abraham find a moil to perform a breast?
Yeah. Don't you think it's interesting that, when you study the story of King Saul, King Saul ultimately, he falls apart for a lot of reasons, but the big issue that's chronicled with King Saul is that he imposed a set of rules on what his army could eat. and how they would go about preparing the meat for to eat, that was his own set of laws, and then condemned his own army when they didn't follow his laws, which were, you know, unstated in the Torah. He was adding to the Torah based upon his own set of laws. Definitely. Now, you mentioned where did he find a rabbi to do a brisk when was speaking with Abraham? Yahweh doesn't say how much to cut off. He doesn't say there's any ceremony involved in doing the clipping. He doesn't say who has to do the clipping. It's strictly a sign. It's something that is done that Yahweh doesn't want us all caught up in how much, by whom, and where. It's just the when and why.
Right. And there was no notes came back then.
Yeah. The very fact for an adult that Novocaine, that there would be some discomfort for a very short period of time associated with this, that you're doing something and essentially you're signing your commitment to participate in the covenant at a personal expense and with some blood is important. Chanan, mercy, is undeserved, but it doesn't make it free.
No.
You're free to choose it. You're free to avail yourself of it. But just because it's undeserved doesn't mean that it's without action. This idea of the gospel of grace, where you're saved by faith and not of anything that you yourself have done, is the antithesis of what Yahweh says. You want to participate in the covenant. There's a lot that you need to do. We'll be back tomorrow.